Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by John Holbein, who is the co-author with Sunshine Hillegas of Making Young Voters, Converting Civic Attitudes into Civic Action. This book was published by Cambridge University Press in 2020, and it is a really interesting and broad explanation and discussion of youth voting attitudes and, to some degree, some of the questions around how young people act in politics and translating that into voting. But I'm going to let John tell us a lot about that. First, I'd like to welcome John Holbein to the New Books in Political Science podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this particular project with Sunshine Hillegas. Hi, John.
Hi, Lily. Thanks for having me. So I'm an assistant professor of public policy, politics, and education at the Frank Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy at the University of Virginia. And my co-author, Sunshine Hillegas, is a professor of political science at Duke University. So we came to this project when I was a graduate student at Duke there with Sunshine, and we were talking one day about young people, about our experience in the classroom specifically, talking to young people. Now, the types of students who are taking political science classes are not representative of young people as a whole, but it was just interesting that both of us seemed to have a similar experience in talking to young people about their levels of political engagement. And many of them would express to us that they were interested in politics, that they followed it on the news, they shared articles with their followers on Twitter or other social media, and that they cared about politics more generally, but that they didn't actually show up and cast a ballot, that many of them sort of had levels of engagement or levels of interest in politics, but didn't actually translate that into engagement and active voting. And so we said to ourselves, what gives? You know, what's going on here? Why is it that there's this disconnect between young people who seem to want to work to affect change and to work for good government and hold government accountable when it falls short, but they fail to show up and actually do so? So that's the genesis of this book. It was actually in our experience in the classroom and thinking about why are young people that we interacted with on a very individual level did not engage in politics. And so that's how this book sort of came about, was this puzzle of why young people don't turn out in American elections.
And of course, you know, we hear about this every election season that, you know, there are a lot of young people out there and people on the news and pundits always tell us, yes, there are a lot of young people out there, but they never vote. This is like a sort of constant evergreen commentary. And yet your research suggests that they are more involved in politics than most people give them credit for being. But there's a lot of literature about sort of the lack of voting by young people. There's literature in political science and in other fields as well. What is this general literature about in terms of pinpointing or at least discussing why young people don't vote? What's the general consensus there?
Yeah, so there's a lot of excellent work that focuses on young people. It turns out it is actually hard to study this group. you know, the fact that they answer surveys at lower rates than older citizens makes it a little bit challenging. But there is really good work out there that explores the many reasons why young people potentially don't cast a ballot. And one of our goals in this book was to really bring together the insights that that literature has given us, and to expand upon that and to sort of say, let's try and write the sort of coherent narrative and story of why young people don't cast a ballot in the United States. And one of the misnomers that comes a little bit into that literature, that academic literature, but is very present in popular accounts of sort of explaining why youth don't turn out and cast a ballot, is that they're disinterested or apathetic towards politics. You don't have to look hard to find examples of pundits bemoaning millennials being sort of selfish and disengaged and disinterested in contributing their voice to elections. And what we found in really digging deep into the survey data across many different survey samples, across various different measures of engagement and sort of psychological interest in participating in politics, young people score very high. If you look at their levels of political interest, it's very high. And that is especially so in recent years. You know, a full 7 out of 10 young people will say that they're interested in politics. A full 8 out of 10 will say that they intend to vote. But they don't actually follow through on that sort of expressed interest, that expressed desire to participate. So that sort of that really was kind of a little bit surprising to us, to sort of see that this very common narrative about young people doesn't actually hold up with data, at least on the measures of political interest that we have and that are often used by political scientists and scholars of political behavior. Young people seem to be hooked and to be engaged in politics, sort of at least psychologically. Where they really struggle is in the follow through of translating that into action at the ballot box.
And you sort of talk about this in the book, and you break the book up into two parts, talking first about like this question of follow through, which takes you and your co-author to some degree a little bit outside of some of the political science literature itself. And then you talk next about the sort of the policies that might draw more follow through. So can you first talk about this, what you refer to as non-cognitive skills that have an impact on the potential follow through from interest to actually voting?
Yeah. So, to do this, we sort of said to ourselves, okay, what do we know as social scientists, more generally about what stops people from sort of following through on their good intentions? And there's a whole literature in economics and psychology and education and human development that thinks about these issues in a variety of different contexts. Not so much in terms of voting, maybe surprisingly. But one of the things we sort of thought about early on is, well, maybe, you know, we often think about voting as sort of this distinct and pro-social act, and it's sort of different from other forms of human behavior. We said, well, maybe it's not. Maybe voting is very similar actually to like exercising or studying, in that most people feel like, oh, it's kind of a good idea that I should be doing this. I get some sort of psychological pleasure from doing this. I know that people around me think there's a social norm that I should be doing this. But I still don't follow through. So maybe voting is similar to these types of behaviors. So in digging into that literature, it's pretty clear that the types of attributes, or the types of people who follow through on their intention to exercise or to work hard in school or to succeed in the labor force, are the types of people who have higher levels of self-control and higher social skills. So they're intertwined with other people who they work well with, who help reinforce social norms for the behaviors that they're going to be doing. And then they also have high levels of self-control, that they have high levels of self-regulation in their thoughts, motivations, emotions, and behavior, that they can control those and that they can sort of keep going when obstacles get in the way. And so what we found was that some of these measures of non-cognitive skills, grit, delayed gratification, other batteries of self-regulation, number one, are really related to one another. People who have sort of one of these skills tend to have them as a bundle. But moreover, the people who have developed these non-cognitive skills, these ability to keep going when obstacles or distractions or difficulties get in the way, those people are actually much more likely to cast a ballot as well. And we think that this sort of should make a little bit of sense, that individuals, when the election day comes and say they've had a busy day at work and they're tired and maybe their kid is sick or they have other things that they need to do at home or Netflix is beckoning to them, individuals who sort of say, no, I'm going to keep following through and I'm going to push through to achieve my goal of being an active citizen, are much more likely to do so, or to, when they show up at the ballot box and see a long line, they say, okay, well, I'm going to persevere, even though this is an obstacle that's in the way, I'm going to keep going. So we can think about this before election day too, that individuals who have these attitudes of perseverance and self-control are more likely to keep going when they face an obstacle, say their voter registration form is returned, or they find other electoral rules to be cumbersome and confusing. So that's sort of our effort to dig into, okay, well, we know that some people actually do overcome the barriers that they face. Some people do follow through. What makes them different? What separates them from individuals who struggle to follow through a little bit? And what we found across a lot of different data sets, lots of different samples of younger and older people as well, individuals who happen to develop these skills were much more likely to follow through and cast a ballot than those that weren't.
And so this also goes to a lot of the literature that I've seen and I've talked to my students about and I've talked to my colleagues about with regard to the sort of habit of voting. That if you sort of have the capacity to overcome some of these potentially stumbling blocks put in front of you the first time that you do it, then you're also more likely to develop the habit of it, sort of like going to the gym,
right?
I would assume.
Yeah, it seems that all of us sometimes wish that we had more of a habit in that area. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think these things can be self-reinforcing, right? What we know, we have a good sense from a lot of different studies with different methodological approaches that once you get a young person started voting, that tends to reinforce itself, right? There are gains from just experiencing the act of voting, from knowing sort of what it's going to be like. It sort of demystifies it. And we actually heard this a lot from young people that we interviewed for the book, was that before they cast a ballot, the ones who were successful in casting a ballot, before they cast the ballot, they were sort of intimidated. They didn't know what to expect. And then they went and actually filled out a registration form. And they said, oh, that was a little bit easier than I thought it was going to be. And they cast a ballot and they were like, oh, I know how to do this now. Maybe I could do that again. So that's totally, I think that's totally real, that once you get a young person started voting to begin with, that tends to feed on itself in many cases. However, the problem is that many young people just don't get set on that path to begin with, that it's just that it sort of works, that habit works. It works its magic in the negative direction, that they don't vote to begin with. And then that perpetuates throughout their lives.
And that's also one of the aspects that you point out in the research, that the habit forming goes in both directions. That if you do form the habit to vote, if you overcome the barriers and you get used to doing it, then you keep doing it. And if you never, then you form the habit of never doing it. Even if you are politically excited or somehow engaged otherwise. So that this habit connection is important to understanding also what young people are doing at this point. To ask another question about this issue of non-cognitive skills and the role that this has with regard to voting, as a sort of conclusion to or add on to sort of civic engagement, You also note, and you sort of mentioned this, that there are many hurdles. And there's a lot of research, again, about the hurdles to voting in the United States compared to other countries. Can you talk about what you saw in your research with regard to questions like voter registration, you know, having clear addresses, a lot of these aspects that are in place because we also have different voting determinants in different states?
Yeah, so we it's pretty clear to us based on the evidence that we present in the book that young people are especially sensitive to how complex and difficult it is to cast a ballot. So we come at this from two different directions. So one was the qualitative interviews, just talking with young people, so a mix of young people who did and didn't cast a ballot across several states. And what we heard again and again was, well, I'm kind of confused by this process. This doesn't seem easy or straightforward. It's not something that I typically do. Many of these young people who are going to, say college or getting a job directly out of high school are coming out of an environment. This is not universally true, but many of them are coming out of an environment where filling out forms is kind of something that their parents do, right? So the thought of transitioning into adult life where one has to fill out a voter registration form, it's just a new thing for them. They're in a part of their lives where they are becoming adults, right? And that part, that process is not easy or straightforward. And so when difficulties come, when say if they forgot to sign their voter registration form and it gets kicked back to them, that might be enough to just stop them right in the process because of the sort of the newness of it and the difficulty in other aspects of their life. It's just a time of tumult and change where many of them are moving and coming into their own, starting intense work or schooling options. So that came through again and again in our interviews with young people. It was just very clear to us that voting was just one of the many things that young people had to deal with. And they found that process to be just a little confusing and overwhelming. And in fact, we found a study that was done before our work that looked at voter registration forms that really coded up a sample of young people who are sending in voter registration forms and looked at them and saw if they were doing it correctly. And they found in that study, I don't have the citation offhand, but they found that about half of the young people in their sample who sent in a voter registration form made a mistake on their voter registration form that would kick it back to young people. So this is a potential choke point for young people. And we saw this in the data as well. Voter registration is a barrier that young people find to be difficult to overcome. It might seem very simple and straightforward to those of us who've navigated this process before and are very savvy about the ins and outs of registering to vote. But for young people, voter registration is a challenge. So we see that reforms that make voter registration easier or more accessible, reforms like online voter registration, which allows young people to register online in a format that they're perhaps more used to, same day registration that allows them to register when they show up at the ballot box, if they have perhaps forgotten to do so or made an error in their voter registration, had a kickback, and then pre-registration reforms that help young people register when they're at home with their parents, often reinforce that with other help in the classroom and at the DMV, those types of reforms that make the voter registration process more accessible, better timed, and allowed if a young person has forgotten to register to vote or just missed out on registering to vote before, say, a registration deadline. Those types of reforms, though they have modest effects on older citizens, tend to have pretty large and robust effects on young people. So pre-registration increases youth turnout somewhere on the order of 3 to 6 percentage points. Same day registration is a bit more than that, and online registration is a little bit less than that. But when put together, it became very clear to us that many reforms that make voter registration easier tend to have larger impacts on young people. So that's, you know, both in our conversations with young people and in the empirical evidence, it suggests that young people find voter registration to be confusing, intimidating, overwhelming, and reforms that make voter registration easier tend to help young people.
And you know, I live in the state of Wisconsin, and so we've had a bunch of changes in the last just couple of years with regard to voting, registration, pre-voting, and just sort of trying to navigate that without necessarily having ever done it before. Also seems like it might be intimidating to a 20-year-old who sort of is interested, but isn't quite sure like who to ask also, I'm assuming.
Yeah, that's right. So many of them, so we're actually seeing a lot of organizations now that are trying to mobilize young people move from this space where they're sort of saying like, oh, we've got to get young people interested. Let's get some more celebrities to get out and just convince them that voting is so cool and so hip and the thing that they want to do. Moving from that world to a model where it's really like helping them fill out voter registration forms, providing them with a mentor who has navigated this process before. So there's a lot of peer-to-peer type interventions going on right now. Yet to be tested for their effects, but it's moving from a world where we're focusing on sort of political interest as the entry point, moving to a world where we're thinking about follow through and the actual obstacles that young people tell us that they face, which seem kind of arcane and mundane and sort of like on the ground. It's like, oh, well, maybe just helping them fill out their voter registration form and send that in, maybe that's going to help, right? So that it's a different way of trying to get young people actively engaged that focuses on follow through instead of interest.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And that, again, is one of the points of your research sort of highlights that is not necessarily absent, but it's not one that has been fully researched in a lot of the political science scholarship prior to what you were looking at, from what I can see, although I'm not an expert on sort of this area in political science scholarship. But I was really intrigued by what you were finding in terms of some of these questions around the non-cognitive skills and how those are impacting particularly young people who might be a little bit nervous about doing this for the first time. And different than when you get your driver's license, you actually have to have a lot of driving, you know, sort of learning behind the wheel. There isn't any voter learning behind the wheel going on for the most part.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, it's sort of, there's two different ways that you could take this, right? One is, well, you know, to increase voter turnout, we could enhance young people's non-cognitive skills. We could teach them to keep going when difficult things arise. Maybe that has payoffs outside of just the political realm. But also, like you were saying, maybe it's just giving them opportunities to practice as well. So that, you know, maybe it's easier to sort of say like, okay, let's do a demonstration in high school classrooms about what it's going to be like when they show up at the ballot box, what they're going to be asked for, what the ballot's going to look like, what the voting booth is going to look like, things like that. And there's actually some good evidence from the First Time Voter program that we cite in the paper randomized control trial that shows that simply going into a high school classroom, spending about 45 minutes demonstrating with a voting booth and a ballot, providing young people the opportunity to register to vote there and then talking about the importance of voting, had some pretty big effects on youth turnout, right? So there are these like two different ways that we could take this, given that we know that follow through is a problem, right? We could enhance young people's non-cognitive skills. That turns out to increase voter participation, but also giving them a chance to practice and to become, to sort of bring down the psychological barriers to voting, to make it a little bit easier in that regard, that actually helps as well, right? So this, I think that solving the youth turnout problem is not, there's no silver bullet to this. So we have to think about, like, how do we both simultaneously make the voting process easier from, like, you know, using same-day registration, pre-registration, online registration, those kinds of things. We also should be thinking about how do we bring down these psychological costs that young people face, the sort of demystifying the voting process and making it easier and less intimidating to them isn't just about sort of the election rules and election laws that they face, but it's about the experience itself, and helping them experience that brings down the cost of voting in a way that has sort of not been appreciated. You know, when we say as political scientists, the cost of voting, that's almost synonymous with like election laws, right? The cost of voting is much more nuanced and much more complex, especially for young people. It's internal to them as well. It's the way that they think about politics and how intimidated or not intimidated they are with it. So this is a multifaceted approach that we're arguing for in the book. Yes, we should make voting laws easier. There are lots of young people who are disenfranchised by those. Yes, we should do interventions, perhaps in the classroom and households, that make the psychological costs of voting go down. And yes, we should be teaching young people to persevere and to keep going in the types of, which is going to be really important, the types of like states where election laws aren't going to be made easier in the foreseeable future, right? We can't just abandon those young people in places where election laws are actually getting more restrictive, more difficult, more confusing. I think there is something to be said about teaching young people to keep going, to overcome those obstacles in those places. It's not putting blame on them to any respect, but it's also trying to help them given the current political climate where they live.
And again, you know, as we've talked about already, that young people tend to also be somewhat mobile. So they may move, you know, from home to college and then from college to someplace else. So they're moving across various states that have different laws. And so then they have to adjust each time and figure out the new path, even in the midst of having some of those laws change, which also makes it harder to develop that habit, which, you know, I think some of your research is highlighting, you know, these difficulties, these barriers to entry. But you also talk about in the book, the second part of the book, this question of policies beyond the sort of change in voter and sort of voter access to try to pull people into sort of voting as part of their political participation and interest. Can you talk a little bit about how that came into the dialogue within the book's conversation?
Yeah, so what we wanted to do in this book was provide useful information for folks who are on the ground trying to get young people engaged. So it was really, you know, I have a public policy background. I'm at a policy school now. My degree is in a PhD in public policy. I really cared about sort of saying, okay, well, it's great to say that, you know, we've non-cognitive skills matter and we've sort of underappreciated that in the literature, but we wanted to think about how to transfer that to the policy world as well. So that's where section two of the book that thinks about what types of reforms that we could do to increase the chances that young people cast about. That's where it came from. And I have sort of a side interest in education policy. I've done some work on various aspects of school choice and school accountability. So I was coming to this book thinking a lot about like, okay, well, schools are a key touch point that many young people, most if not all young people go through, and they spend most of their time there. What is being done right now in schools to fulfill the mission of public schools, especially to make active and informed young citizens? So it's very easy, and we talk about this in the book. We did a pretty extensive review of the history of civics education in the United States and the vision that was put forth as far back as the founding fathers and to common more recent thought leaders today. And the vision was that schools would act as this catalyst for young people to be informed and engaged in self-governance, right? That this would be a public education system was, you know, at its roots advocated for because it would help form a bedrock for citizenship. And so that's one of the key chapters in section two says, how are schools doing right now? Where is it that they could improve? What effect does, you know, taking a civics class today have on the chances that young people vote? It turns out that just taking sort of the status quo civics course that most young people are exposed to doesn't have much of an impact. Doesn't taking more of those types of classes doesn't increase the odds that they vote. But being exposed to sort of applied learning programs, programs that teach them how to be engaged in politics, yes, sort of by giving them voter registration forms, doing the mechanics of helping them register and practice voting, that's important. But also more broadly, the types of schools that are trying to live up to their mission as public schools of making schools mini labs for democracy, giving young people opportunities to and assigning them as part of their curricula to get out in the community and to work as teams to solve problems on the ground, to meet with elected officials, to discuss contemporary political issues in the classroom together. These types of programs that we see in some places in the United States and also elsewhere sort of springing up have, as it turns out, a pretty big impact on the chances that young people will participate in politics. So we cite in the book a great study that I think is by a group from Mathematica that looked at the effect of democracy prep charter schools. And democracy charter schools are a controversial thing, but democracy prep charter schools have a really interesting model in that they make democratic engagement a part of the curricula for young people. It's woven through everything students do in all of their classes, of sort of engaging with social problems, trying to overcome them, thinking about what's being talked about in the news today as it relates to political debates. And it turns out that this study found comparing students who lotteried in to democracy prep charter schools to those who didn't lottery in, that being exposed to this model of sort of active learning increased the chances that they voted later on in their lives by a pretty substantial amount. So this is I think, a second pathway. When we're thinking about policies, we often think about electoral reforms, and we often forget the classroom, right? Because some of the early work on civics education showed not promising effects, right? So back in the 1960s, there were political scientists who sort of the early studies on civics education were not promising, and so we sort of dropped that line of inquiry. In the book, we're sort of trying to say, okay, let's pick up where those studies left off, and there have been some work since then, but let's pick up and think about, okay, what is it exactly that civics is doing wrong? And what we talk about in the book is that it's mostly the approach, the pedagogical approach. In most civics education programs is not focused on social action. It's not applied learning. It's not practicing voting and talking about contemporary political issues. It's really just a history class, an American history class, where young people are encouraged to memorize facts about the founding fathers, various aspects of American history, or the history of other places in some classes. That approach is widely used today, but it just doesn't appear to work in terms of encouraging young people to vote. So when we're thinking about public policies, there is a new model and a new way of thinking about civics education that involves more active applied learning that has proven, at least early on in these pilot programs, these randomized controlled trials, to have positive impacts on the chances of young people vote.
And you know, I've sort of worked with a variety of different civics approaches, civic engagement approaches. And I know the American Political Science Association has a lot of work on this and scholarship on this. The idea of experiential learning, essentially, putting students on the ground in active roles or in roles in terms of changing their communities, changing something, seems to be how we might shift our thinking about civic engagement. Is that correct? Is that what the research showed?
Yeah, that's right. You know, for a long time, this is actually like sort of getting back to a debate, or it aligns with the debate in political science, which is, you know, for a long time, we've sort of gotten really upset about low levels of political knowledge, like young people and others not performing well on sort of the standard battery of measures of political knowledge. And what we're arguing is like, okay, don't forget that stuff. Like, don't forget to teach young people about history and various aspects of American government. That's important, but it's not enough. It's not sufficient. If you want them engaged, it's got to be active learning. It's got to be on the ground, practicing, being involved in various forms of being engaged in their community. That type of model actually has been shown in the United States, in the Democracy Prep charter schools, and then also in a few instances in the United Kingdom that have tried to, they tend to call it social action over there. There have been evaluation studies that have shown that that this approach over there as well is increasing youth voter participation. So some randomized control trials that compare individuals who are exposed to these social action programs show that they actually, they not only promote young people's willingness to engage in democracy, but they're also, as a side benefit, teaching young people non-cognitive skills, right? So it's the unit, you give young people a team and a social issue to tackle, say it's something as plain as, increasing the amount of recycling in their community that's available in their community, right? A fairly vanilla issue. But nonetheless, an opportunity for them to think about why it is that people don't recycle, why it is that how they would go about increasing access to recycling, how they would persuade people to do that, and giving them an opportunity to work together in teams to face obstacles to their goal enhances their ability to do that in other contexts as well, enhances their levels of grit, enhances their ability to work well with other people. So these things tend to feed into each other as well. When done right, these types of active learning increase civic engagement, right? Engagement in the domain. But they also tend to have some side benefits of teaching young people general skills that can translate into other aspects of their life as well.
And this is a really comprehensive book in terms of using a variety of different methodological approaches, and also synthesizing a lot of research that's coming from a variety of different disciplines. So it's both interdisciplinary and a sort of multi-method approach. Can you talk about how you and Sunshine designed this sort of, really comprehensive approach to not only the methods, but also the disciplinary sort of reach?
Yeah, so our desire in writing this book was to get a little bit outside of the political science literature and draw insights from economics, psychology, child development, education, policy. And in fact, one of the moments that contributed to the sort of genesis of this book happened when I was taking in graduate school an education policy course. And we were talking about how non-cognitive skills are so important for performance in school, performance in the labor force, other aspects of individual well-being. And I said to myself, I'm a political scientist. I wonder if they're important for political behaviors as well. So this was sort of an inflection point where it was, totally a different context, an economics of education class, thinking about, oh, okay, I wonder if this matters for voting as well. So that was an important part of this process that really helped us, I think, sharpen our argument, to think about what we know from other disciplines. That really helped us to translate this into a political science realm where we're thinking about behaviors that political scientists tend to think about much more. So that was really helpful for us. In terms of the methodological approach, our goal here was to get our best estimates of the effect of various sort of pre-voting experiences and inputs to youth voting, get the best sort of causal estimates that generalize as much as we could, right? But it's pretty clear to us in writing this book, or at least to me for myself, that in doing that, in desiring to sort of estimate the causal impact of various programs, the causal impact of various skills or attributes that young people do or don't develop, that there are constraints in doing so. It's not always the case that we have a gold standard randomized control trial at our fingertips. So our desire was to be as comprehensive as possible, to try and use the best methodological approach that we could. And in many instances, the big challenge was finding a data set where we could measure the things that we wanted simultaneously. You know, the big challenge for samples that political scientists often use is that they often don't think about these types of non-cognitive skills, or at least they think about them differently, and they haven't measured them as often, and they often measure them just among adults instead of sort of pre-voting young people. And the challenge from, you know, other disciplines that have thought about non-cognitive skills for a little bit longer is they're often not thinking about civic engagement as a potentially important life outcome. So this was a challenge going into it. So we were, you know, in many cases having to use data sets where we were just so lucky that there happened to be a voting question put on through a longitudinal survey of young people that was focused on mental health or labor force participation or school performance. So we were often sort of, you know, taking samples that we could from cobbling them together from various sources. But this is also a part of our desire to do the best job that we could, while acknowledging also that there are inherently methodological constraints in pushing forward a new argument, a new idea, a new literature, or pushing forward a literature that already existed, rather. So we were trying to take many different approaches, different sort of observational methods, various experimental methods when those were available, to craft this argument together.
And that was, I mean, I found it really useful to see like the different methodological approaches woven together to sort of bolster the research in general. And I wonder, you have an interesting line in the acknowledgments about having quite a few journal rejections forcing you and your co-author to actually write a book. And I'm wondering if that was dependent on some of the broadness of both your methodological approach and the disciplinary approach.
Yeah, so it was a little bit of a challenge at first. We had a couple of very close calls at a couple of the journals that, you know, very, very thoughtful reviews. But it was a big challenge to talk about non-cognitive skills to an audience that often didn't really think about this, these attributes very much. So even the term itself, non-cognitive skills, is a little bit confusing. So we would often hear things like, what do you mean it's not cognitive? You know, where is it? If it's not in the brain, you know, it's, what is this thing? And, you know, we talk about in the book what we should be calling these things and the debate over that's gone on in other fields. But this was a big challenge, right, to try and think about introducing a new set of attributes that we've kind of ignored for a long period of time that have been explored in other disciplines, to bring that to political science. You know, it's also, you know, a standard journal article doesn't have quite the space to talk about the different assumptions, the different conceptualizations that are used in various methodological approaches. So, you know, in this case, I think rejection worked it out for the better. It helped us to craft and hone our thinking and expand and think about where these non-cognitive skills come from and whether or not they're teachable and malleable and their various aspects that we just couldn't do it in a journal article.
Well, I found the book really interesting, and certainly one that could also be read by, or should also be read by, many scholars in a variety of different fields, not just in political science, because of, you know, some of these questions around civic engagement, education, psychology, and so forth. So I wonder now, John, what you are working on and what your co-author, Sunshine Hillegas, are working on.
Yeah. So a bit more of this. You know, there's, I think we definitely left some lingering questions in the book. Some of my more recent research is delving even earlier in the life course. So a lot of the stuff that we do in the book is sort of teenage years, right? So, you know, mid to, you know, middle school to high school years. I've been interested for a long time about the influence of childhood experiences. We have a long theoretical literature on political socialization about the importance of early life experiences. We don't have as robust of an empirical literature on that. And this literature, you know, according to many, is stagnated in recent years. So I'm doing some work to push forward on how various childhood experiences influence adult voting. Sunshine's working on a variety of different things, thinking about surveying young people and thinking about how to measure and promote these non-cognitive skills among young people still. So we're pressing forward to try and get more young people actively involved in democracy.
That sounds great. When you finish the next book, will you come back on the New Books in Political Science podcast and talk to me about it?
For sure.
Excellent. I look forward to it. Thank you, John Holbein, for joining me today to talk about Making Young Voters, Converting Civic Attitudes into Civic Action, published in 2020 by Cambridge University Press. I assume this is available, obviously, at Cambridge University Press's website. Is there perhaps a brick and mortar store that one can access virtually that you would like to give a shout out to?
So you can also pick this up at Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com and a variety of other places where books are available.
All right. Thank you, John Holbein, for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you very much.